You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here on this sunny Monday afternoon for Leonard Lopate. With her debut novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, Ayanna Mathis has created a tremendous stir. The book, which is a series of linked stories, covers 50 years in the life of Hattie Shepherd, an African-American woman who moves north as a teenager to escape the restrictions of Jim Crow. And it's also about the lives of her 11 children and one grandchild. The book has been getting raves. Michiko Kakutani called it an astonishingly powerful novel in her December 5 review in the New York Times, and Oprah Winfrey selected it for her book club. It's just out from Alfred A. Knopf, and I am pleased that it brings Ayanna Mathis to the show today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. What a delight to be here.
You know, when the story opens in 1925, Hattie is just 17 years old, and she's newly married. And what we find happens next, it's like your heart gets broken right at the beginning of the book. Can you tell us how you begin?
Sometimes I think about it, I think, my God, that's just so harrowing for the reader. But I think that Hattie is so much shaped and informed by what happens to her at the beginning of her life. And because she is in some ways a difficult woman, I find her to be sort of deeply lovable. But she's not easy. You know, there's even a line in the book when someone says about her, you know, you are not easy to love or you're hard to love. And she is. But I think that a reader... And also me, I think, as a writer, could sort of access her better if I understood what had, in many ways, made her the way that she is, and what robs her in so many ways of her ability to be tender, which is I think, the biggest thing about Hattie, not that she can't love, but that she has an enormous difficulty with tenderness and with affection.
And in that first scene, she loses two babies, mm-hmm. and... It is as if you see, in fact, she's described often as being the color, being silvered over with ice. Mm. It's almost as if you see that ice encapsulate her, mm-hmm. and it's her whole life trying to break through that mm-hmm. after that.
Yeah, very much so. And it's interesting because I think that the thing about Hattie that is still endlessly fascinating to me is that I don't completely understand her. I think that she's just incredibly complex to me. And I wonder sometimes if she is attempting to break out of the ice, or if for a long time she's just sort of resigned to having to live inside of it. And I think it's not really until the end of the novel, the very, very last chapter, that she understands that there is a possibility of some melting or some thawing. Before that, I think that she just thinks, well, this is just how this is going to be.
There's a glimpse of it. I know you're prepared to read for us about not her first baby, but her last baby. So
yes.
Could you read a little bit for
Certainly.
Us from that chapter?
Certainly. This chapter is called Ella. I'm just going to read very briefly. In this chapter, Hattie is going through a very, very difficult decision, which is to give her last-born baby away to her sister. Down the hall, the children slept three to a bedroom. Hattie could almost hear them growing, their wrists lengthening and poking out beyond the cuffs of their sleeves, their feet outgrowing their shoes, their shoulders widening and pulling the fabric of their coats taut. For the last 2 weeks, she had fed them navy beans with ham bones for dinner and powdered milk and oats for breakfast. They were lean. They had a hard look that was disturbing in a child's face. Ella was born at the end of an unusually hot April. Hattie went into labor while standing over a tub of laundry she'd taken in to make extra money. Her labor was scarcely 3 hours, and after the doctor left the house, a few of Hattie's neighbors came, women from the block who turned up for births and funerals or an occasional glass of tea on the porch. They cleaned up the blood, looked after the other children, and brought some of whatever they'd cooked that day, a pot of string beans, a platter of chicken. The oldest of them, Willie, was from somewhere in the Carolinas. Willie had been old for as long as anyone could remember. She was a mud-colored woman with a drawl so thick it sounded as though she'd come up from Boogaloo the day before. The younger women thought Willie countrified, though most of them were from the country themselves. They were, most of them, perpetually donning and polishing their northern city selves, molting whatever little southern town they or their families had come from 5 or 10 or 20 years before, whatever red dirt roads or sharecropped fields, or bragging about their family's wide porches in whatever good Negro neighborhood they'd lived in, which was just a roundabout way of demanding that Philadelphia give them their due. Willie took Hattie's afterbirth and buried it under an oak in front of the house. The tree was a great big old thing, with roots so thick and strong they broke through the squares of concrete. So the child's spirit will stay close to home, Willie said. The neighborhood women did not want to admit they believed in such things, but they always let Willie into their birthing rooms. Later, they'd cluck their tongues and shake their heads and say, "It's a shame Willie never learned any better." But they were too smart to turn their backs on the possibility of luck or fortune or a blessing in any form it might take. If Willie's juju offered some promise that their children would prosper in Philadelphia, then so be it. Hattie thought them naive and stupidly hopeful, though she too allowed Willie to perform her ritual. And, of course, the other women of Wayne Street had been wounded and chastened by the North just as Hattie had been. But she was so insistent on the singularity of her disappointment that she could not see that she wasn't alone in her circumstance.
There's so much in that passage, as there is in this book, and I'm glad you chose that one because, for me, Willie was such a powerful figure. She only shows up a couple of times, but each time it's as if everything changes.
Yeah. Yeah, she's really sort of magical in this way. I wanted to always kind of avoid stereotypes of a kind of magical Southern juju woman, and I don't think that Willie is that. But what she does function as is a person who is sort of more real than real. As much as, you know, her sort of birthing rituals and burying the afterbirth under an oak would imply a kind of mysticism, which of course it does in a certain sort of way. What Willie generally does is kind of see through people's masks and see through all of their layers of ice. In Hattie's case, in the case of another character later in the book, Belle, sees through all of their inability to sort of function in a real way in the world. She just sort of cuts through it. And in that sense, she's kind of not magical at all, but I guess hyper-real and hyper-compassionate as well.
And able to see, to sit still and look at somebody else, as opposed to being, everybody else is moving so fast, even Hattie.
Yeah, Hattie.
Especially Hattie. And the other thing from that chapter about Ella, her last daughter, there's this incredibly poignant moment where she's just holding her and smelling her and trying to remember what she's going to be like when she has to let her go.
Yeah, that was I don't tend to be particularly emotional when I'm writing, but that made me very, very sad because I did, you know, sort of begin to think, and the book talks about it, Hattie's kind of projections into the future and this imagining if she sees this child again, which she doesn't know when or if she will, she assumes she will at some point, and that the child will call her auntie maybe, or maybe she'll call her Miss Hattie, and she won't know her to be her own mother. And obviously the moment of giving the child away when she's a baby affects Hattie enormously, sort of unspeakably deep. But she also thinks a lot about what that's going to mean in the future and how that will be to have a child that is stranger to you.
And that idea of tenderness and loss is twinned in many places in the book.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they seem to be sort of, they are, I think, inextricably linked. The more Hattie suffers loss, the more she recedes, I think, into her kind of icy cage, really. And I think that is for the obvious reasons that it protects her. But I think that it is also for the slightly less obvious reason that she more and more thinks that the world is capable of unspeakable cruelty, and that it's not going to stop being capable of unspeakable cruelty. And in her mind, I think that that not manifesting her love to her children as tenderness is a way to prepare and protect them. In her mind, that is a great deal of love that she's showing them. Look, the world is not necessarily going to sort of receive you with open arms. There is not a lot of kindness in this world. So I'm going to teach you how to be tough, and I'm going to keep you alive, of course.
Yeah, it's almost like helping them develop the calluses that'll serve them, although it also deprives all of them of that tenderness. But all of the children, and each chapter is from a different child's perspective, all of them express the connection and the love that they have for her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I mean, she's a larger-than-life figure, of course, and especially in this tiny household. You know, Wayne Street, which is how the house where they grow up in is referred to, really, generally speaking, as Wayne Street. And it's really small, and there are a lot of bodies in it. And Hattie is this kind of enormous figure in this tiny, cramped house. And I think also her children, because they are so, I mean, they yearn for her. They really yearn for her. And so they all kind of grow up with this mother want that they can't shake. And it gets expressed in different kinds of ways. And I think that the mother want also, Hattie has something of a frightening and destructive legacy, which is that, as I just read in the section from Ella, she doesn't quite understand that it is possible to have relationships with other people, that it is possible to seek comfort from other people. And her children similarly are unable to understand that. They seek, I think, in a sort of a way, they seek comfort from Hattie, but they assume that they won't get it. But, I mean, these are a lot of siblings, and they really, with the exception of Allison Billups, which is another chapter in the book, they almost never seek comfort from each other. And that is sort of something they've learned from their mother.
When did Hattie and her children come to you, and how?
It's sort of a funny story. I always, when I'm asked this question, I always want to sound like a big genius. And I was walking down the street and suddenly I envisioned this, you know, this family, and it was incredible. I saw them in the greatest detail. But that's not true.
Which is a relief to the rest of us, actually.
I was studying at the time. I was at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I had begun working on kind of a botched-ish memoir before I went to Iowa. And it was not very good. And I fictionalized it. It was very different from this book. And I took it into workshop, and it was not well received. And then I had a big crisis about, oh, what am I doing here at Iowa? And oh my gosh! And I walked around crying, and you know, did all these things. And then I was like, well, you know, this was my first semester, so I thought, well, either I can spend the next 2 years weeping, or I can get myself together somehow and work on something. And I thought, I'll work on short stories. And the stories that were coming out were these, not certainly necessarily in the form in which they appear in the book, but they were people of a similar generation. They were all in Philadelphia. I didn't realize until about the third one in that I had a book. I just thought, oh, isn't it kind of funny how these people are all kind of live in Philadelphia, and it's all 1952. You know, sort of what a coincidence. But and then I realized I had a book. So that's kind of how it came, I think.
I'm speaking with Ayanna Mathis about her debut novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, and it's from Alfred A. Knopf. You were studying at Iowa, and Marilyn Robinson was one of your teachers. And there is, in her work, such deep philosophical and also religious resonance. And here you've called this The 12 Tribes of Hattie.
Yeah.
And as I read it, I thought, I wonder if there was some sort of influence or whether this was just something completely separate from that.
I think that there certainly was some sort of influence. I have a great deal of interest in theology and have for many years. I for a long time, kind of tossed around the idea of going to divinity school. And so if you have these things kind of muttering around in the back of your brain, and then you spend any time at all with Marilyn Robinson, they tend to come to the forefront of your brain. And so the title certainly is, you know, is a reference to the biblical tribes of Israel, and to kind of narratives of, you know, leaving oppressive situations and coming into freedom, and then finding the freedom to be not really quite what you thought that it was going to be. So yes, certainly there is that there, and there is certainly also her influence. I used to go to her house. She has an enormous theological library in her house, and she would let me kind of go there and sit at her dining room table and just, you know, look through books for a long time.
That sounds like a wonderful way to learn.
It was kind of the best thing ever.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like you pulling yourself out of, you know, you said you were walking around weeping, and I've heard so many stories like that of the work doesn't come until you go through that kind of, this is not working. This is not going to happen the way I had expected it to.
Yeah, I think there is a sort of painful burning away of a false perceptions about whatever it is that you were working on. Because, it's very hard to kind of realize, look, this is just not working. And I think a lot of times, you know, I knew that it wasn't working. In the back of my mind, I thought, hey, you know, this really does have some problems. But I thought, I don't know what I thought. I thought I could make it better or get away with it. It's kind of like a lazy, you know. And then there comes a moment when it really becomes abundantly clear that it is not working and you are going to have to put it down, which tends to be somewhat painful, I think.
Philadelphia plays a big role in this book. Is that the city where you're from?
It is indeed.
And so was that a conscious thing, that this is a place that you knew, and did you know the history there and how that was going to be, in a way, a character in the book?
I didn't know. It's kind of funny. I was making a joke to somebody the other day that I feel like all of my books will always be set in Philadelphia because I'm completely fascinated by it. When even after I realized that I had a book, after the third story or so, I didn't necessarily think, oh, I'm going to set all of these stories in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is going to become, as you said, a character in this book. Just the stories kept being set in Philadelphia. And I realized that I have a deep fascination with that place that is sort of never going to leave me, I don't think.
You write about Hattie directly at the beginning and in the middle and at the end, and then the rest is seeing her through the eyes of her children. How did she change for you as you developed the characters of her kids and saw her through their eyes?
That's a really great question. I think, first of all, I think that she was so complicated to me that it was very difficult for me to imagine kind of writing her in a conventional way. So to sort of stay very close to her perspective
to see
and keep
her
going on in that way. One, a lot of very difficult things happened to her, so you would kind of end up with this like list of woes, you know, if you sort of wrote her in a more conventional kind of way. But I think that also it was the best way for me to begin to get any kind of handle on who she was. And as the stories progressed, what I began to understand is that I feared making her too simple in any way, shape, or form. I didn't want her to be simply a woman who was wounded by the death of her children, and so then she sort of goes on and acts out for the rest of her life. That's too simple. I didn't want her to be a woman who is wounded by the death of her children and then becomes this kind of iron-willed black woman stereotype who has no feelings or who is. And so getting at her through her children and understanding her really as a writer, understanding her through her children, allowed me to flesh her out and give her nuances, I think, that I also wouldn't have been able to arrive at if I had been writing her more conventionally.
There's also, towards the end of the book, a wonderful and heartbreaking moment where you see the way her children have been watching her. And with Belle, who's one of her daughters, who Willie comes into that story too, but Belle had been watching when her mother was stepping out with someone else. And there's this moment of sort of seeing the different levels of what's going on, is the action and then the child watching this action, which as a parent you're often thinking about, is this being seen and what will it do? And then what the repercussions are for the whole family.
Yeah, I think Hattie is, she's aware of being kind of watched in the home because she is completely aware of her authority and she insists upon her authority. And I think that she is under the impression that her authority prevents her from being seen as a human being, that then all the kids have this kind of blind spot, so they don't ever see her doing anything they don't want her to see.
Right. Them, because, you know, she's mother.
Because she's mother, and that is the role that she has decided to occupy in a kind of extraordinarily dictatorial kind of a way. So she very much is unaware, I think, of the ways in which the things that she does are being interpreted by her children. I don't think that she thinks that she is a person that is interpreted.
Right. And towards the end, there is a more of a self-reflective piece and also a more tender piece, even with Belle, who's in the hospital.
Sure.
And there's a moment where they connect only through a pane of glass, mm-hmm. but they have a connection with written instructions about what's happening outside in the world.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, too. I mean, much has obviously been talked about the book being in the Great Migration. And certainly the Great Migration is enormously important in the book. I don't think it's a book about the Great Migration. I think it's a book about a family and about this woman. But one of the things I think that does happen is that as the book moves forward chronologically, it also Hattie's ability to perceive hope or potential or love or affection increases, because as she gets further away from the terrors of the South, and they were at that time, you know, we're talking about 1923 when she left, they were terrors. And as we get towards 1980, which is the year of the last story in the book, her personal arc, I think, also reflects or parallels in a certain way the arc of the migration and the arc of a kind of Black movement away from total oppression, in which it was necessary to first and foremost keep yourself from dying. As we move away from that, then other things can happen. We can be tender. There is the possibility of hope. There is the possibility of redemption.
Well, that's a wonderful place, I think, to end. I've been speaking with Ayanna Mathis about her debut novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. It's published by Knopf. Ayanna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, what a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.